Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Dish with Dina podcast. Thank you for joining us again this week. Today, my guest is Laura Scrow, a licensed psychotherapist with a private practice in Los Angeles, California. Laura and I dish about switching from judgment to curiosity when it comes to our past behaviors and establishing a mindfulness around our values so that we can overcome barriers to making and taking small steps toward lasting change. So sit back, enjoy the conversation, and let's dish. Welcome, Laura Scrow, to the Dish with Dina podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of a Saturday, no less, to chat with me. How are things going on your neck of the country?
Yeah. Hey, Dina, thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here, even on a Saturday. Things are great. We're getting some cooler weather here in Los Angeles, which is pretty unheard of. So I'm really excited about it. I've got my sweater on and everything.
So here we're kind of easing into some more fall/winter days, but I think snow is in the forecast at the time of this recording. Wow. In a few days from us. So we'll see what happens there. We'll see what happens.
Exciting.
Laura, I want to, as I always do with our initial interviews and the first parts of our conversation, is to just discuss a little bit about how we came to know each other. And in your case, you, I believe, were gracious enough to accept just like a random DM from me, or we came across each other's Instagram pages. Do you remember any of that?
I do. I think maybe there was initially some connection on a Facebook group of some kind, because, you know, I have a private practice. You have sort of your own private practice for what you do. And I think we were in some group for that. And then we connected over Instagram. And Obviously, I loved your vibe. I get the impression you liked my vibe. And so here we are.
Very much so. And before we even got a chance to talk today, we also did an Instagram live together, and we had a conversation about mindful eating and setting boundaries. And it kind of took a lot of different twists and turns, which I'm excited to see if this conversation goes the same way too.
Yeah, there's just so much intersection in what you and I do. It's really great.
Indeed. So why don't we talk a little bit about that? Start first, though, earlier in your life, some earliest childhood memories specifically revolving around food. What were certain things that you ate when you were growing up? What was your culture like? Where did you grow up in the country or outside of the country as well?
Yeah. So I'm born and raised in Southern California. I grew up in the Ventura area. So lots of really, you know, beautiful ocean. So we had a lot of seafood. But it's so funny because when you started asking that, the first thing I thought of that came to my head was Kraft mac and cheese. Like, that is the comfort meal of my life, even to this day, sometimes less often, to the point where when I go visit my family, my dad is always like, let me know if you want me to make you some Kraft mac and cheese. So that's just like something that comes to mind. But as a child, there was a lot of comfort food. There was a lot of, you know, just, I remember meatloaf happening a lot, just like things that felt very like homey. My family were, you know, just, I guess, like at this point, fourth generation Americans. We have some Italian in our family as well. And so, you know, we love Italian food. Pasta has always been something that we grew up eating and enjoyed, and I still enjoy. Not a lot of adventurous, I wouldn't say my parents had an adventurous palate. So a lot of more ethnic foods I didn't start eating until later in life and very much enjoy now. I have a lot of memories of just each of us grabbing a plate of food that was cooked by one of my parents and then sitting on the couch watching a show together. And just, it was very cozy.
Is that really what you did too? Like at the end of every evening during the weekday, you all sat together as a family and ate?
For the most part, yeah. There were some times where, you know, my mom couldn't be part of it because of maybe some health issues that she was going through at the time, or my dad had to work late. But for the most part, I have a lot of memories of us just having dinner together, you know, home-cooked dinner, sometimes takeout, and just like sitting in the living room together, watching whatever show was on or some movie my dad wanted to watch and just hanging out that way. Not a lot of like dinner table dinners that I can remember. Right. But I also have really fond memories of like big breakfast. breakfasts too. There's this photo of me that I still have on my Facebook somewhere of me with like a cat-shaped pancake that my mom made, really cute. And my dad has like a few special big breakfasts that he still makes for us when we come visit. So a lot of just really like home style cooking and big meals kind of a thing.
I love breakfast. Well, I love all
I
food.
love breakfast
I love
also and all food.
breakfast. And breakfast at any time of the day is also very welcome.
Yes.
So you mentioned you didn't necessarily have an adventurous palate, or at least your family didn't when you were growing up, but were you involved in cooking in the kitchen? Like, did you learn how to do things like with assisting?
Absolutely not. So my mom was a stay-at-home parent, in large part due to those health issues that I mentioned. And so I sort of never had to learn how to do anything, and I acknowledge, the privilege in that. Although I will say that when I got to college, it was a tough reality check to learn how to cook and do laundry and do basic things that a lot of my friends already knew how to do. But I feel like I caught up. I can cook pretty decently now. I can follow a recipe. I love to bake as well, so that has thankfully improved. But yeah, it was never really something that I helped out with, or maybe for like some of the big holiday meals. But really, I wasn't required to help, and I really didn't have the initiative to help. Sorry, mom and dad. But yeah, so it's interesting because there were times I remember like the most exciting thing in terms of just like ethnic variety or adventurous food would be like Panda Express. And then when I turned like 20 and started eating things like sushi and Ethiopian food and Peruvian food and all of these amazing cuisines, I was just like, oh, all of that I could have been enjoying that so much sooner. And I'm working on getting my parents to try new and different things, and they've loved everything I've shared with them so far.
That is so interesting to me because I had a bit of an opposite upbringing where I was kind of treated as like child labor when it came to like we did everything as kids. So I'm a child of a first generation, Italian immigrant family, and it was very much like, why aren't you working? And I'm like, I'm 9 years old. Like we can't go into the workforce just yet officially. So they would put us to work at home, and we were doing very domestic types of things with, cleaning the house and doing the laundry and helping. Especially I've mentioned before, we lived upstairs, downstairs in a two-family home with my grandparents. And so I would go and help my grandmother as well with some things too. But I did not grow up either with a very wide variety of food flavors because we cooked almost everything at home. And so it was only when we had some special occasions or begging my family, can we please go eat something else that is not from here? Of course, my father with his tight belt budget was always like, why go eat outside when we can make things at home? And we're like, because that's how you establish, a palate. That's how you experience life.
100%. Once I started traveling, I was like, oh, there's so many exciting things that you can eat that I just did not know about.
And especially in our case, where we were in a little bit more of like a suburban area of New Jersey, but then I ended up in New York City. And similar to you, so you're in, California, LA.
Oh yeah.
How does that affect also the ability that you have at your fingertips or at your footsteps to be able to kind of, try other things? What are some of the things that you have been venturing out to try a little bit more recently and as you kind of got older too?
Yeah, well, this is embarrassing because I really should have realized that I would love this even before, but I've been on like a dumplings kick lately. So I'm talking like any kind of Japanese dumpling, Japanese, Taiwanese, Chinese dumpling, all of it. I'm just obsessed with dumplings now. But I remember the first time that I had sushi. Sushi has changed my life. I'm a fiend for sushi. It has turned into like my top cuisine, but I would have never dreamed of eating that. I had to start out with like the cooked shrimp tempura sushi and then work my way up from there. And now I'll just, do the omakase and ask them to just prepare whatever they want to prepare for me and I'll eat it. But, it's just when you grow up around things that are familiar, venturing out of that can be scary if you don't naturally have like an adventurous spirit, which I would say I sort of do, but maybe not all the time when it comes to food. Even now, like I discovered I loved spicy food. And here I was as a child thinking pepperoni pizza was like too spicy for me, which is also also embarrassing. But now I go for like the medium spice option a lot of the time. And so it's just interesting once you try different things. And like I said, traveling too. So I've traveled all over Europe. I've traveled a little bit in South America. I've been to Peru, where the cuisine is very different, not too far off from like some of the Mexican food I'm used to eating. Being from Los Angeles and the Southern California area, we have really good Mexican food here, thank goodness. But different enough that it was a lot of new textures and flavors for me. And now that it's like most things are good, most things are actually better than you think they're going to be, it's so much easier to try those new dishes and to just, allow yourself to experiment. But yeah, it's just really interesting how we're not exposed to those things, just because of our families. And like you said, being in kind of a suburb of Los Angeles, you'd think I would have had more exposure than that. But it's funny because now every time I go, let's say, to visit a friend in another state, maybe that's not as in a metropolitan area. I remember visiting a friend in Iowa a couple years ago, and I was trying to order, I don't even remember what it was, but it was, some like not generic American cuisine. It was something else. And being like, you can't mess this up. It's so easy. And then of course, like not up to the standard that I have being from Los Angeles now. Like you have access to every type of food at the highest quality here. And so it's hard sometimes to go to other places and be like, I probably shouldn't order this from here just because I'm used to it being so high quality. So I've become a little bit of a snob in that way.
Right. I'm gonna start comparing this too. And that's really, I think adventurous is a great word because especially if we're not brought up with a variety of foods to try out, that it's upon us being independent, individualized, being a little bit outside of our comfort zone, allowing ourselves to try different things. Because I could also find a variety of people who are around the same age group who do not venture off, who do, just stick to their kind of like quote unquote, meat and potatoes, foods and don't really like experimenting, not to mention the threshold level of spiciness as well, like being a little bit scared of that too. So I really think that's so fascinating because I think with food comes experiences, socializing, learning about other cultures, and we kind of do a bit of a disservice if we don't really venture out. But I also understand, like you said too, the privilege of being able to go and pay for a meal and venture out and have that access to that.
Yeah, and I'm sure that played into a lot of what I was exposed to as a child too. We were very, typical middle class. We were fine, but I wouldn't say we had a lot of extra. And so that, played into the type of food. And I think also just being a child of the 90s played into the type of food a lot. That's when like fast food was really at its boom and just a lot of differences in how I approach food now. But it's interesting because when I think about like my own typical week where I'm like cooking a few times a week, I really do order takeout more than I should, but it's okay. You can't live in LA and not be a foodie. So, between the takeout and the cooking, I would say most of the things I eat are still these other type of varieties, different kinds of Asian cuisines, maybe Mexican food one night, maybe Mediterranean food another night. And very rarely do I just have a typical meal of like chicken and vegetables, because now that's like boring to me. And I'm like, that we need something more.
Jazz it up.
So it's interesting. It's like the opposite.
So let's move forward a little bit in that direction because you are a licensed psychotherapist. You have a private practice in your region. And did anything as you were growing up, as you were venturing into college, did you know what you wanted to be? Did any of the things that you were, it's not necessarily specific to food, but did anything play a role in as you were progressing into your career or into your major? Tell us a little bit about how some of those things shaped the current you.
I always like giggle when someone asked me that question because I had no freaking idea what I wanted to do until I just like started to do it. I really sort of stumbled into it. It was one of those things where I was like, oh, I'll just like try this and see if I like it, which is maybe a little too blasé for like committing to grad school, but it worked out. So initially, I had that childhood dream of wanting to like be on Broadway. I love to sing and dance, although I cannot act, so that would not have gone very far. And so I was always very like outgoing and creative. I loved being around people. I loved entertaining people. And then as I got older, through high school, that turned more into just like being the go-to person for my friends. friends. I had a lot of really good friends. That was something fortunately that I never struggled with. And so people would always want to just vent to me or get advice from me. And so being a people person is something that's always come really naturally to me. So that was a great solid start. And then in college, I thought I was going to be like that Jodie Foster Silence of the Lambs kind of criminal profiler thing. And that was not meant to be. But I did
was
get
it
my
the serial killers that threw you off.
I was like, ooh, violent crime, like that sounds fascinating, and it is, but I really have realized I don't want to work on that side of it. But what I did end up doing while I was pursuing a criminology major was I got an internship at my school's rape crisis center, and I started working with survivors of traumatic experiences, and that just completely shifted my entire outlook on what I wanted to do, and you know, the kinds of programming and advocacy that I was interested in creating and giving people. And so I ended up doing a second major in psychology, got my, you know, undergraduate degrees, and then was working in a few nonprofits for a little while, kind of in that advocacy policy space, which was really interesting for me and a great source of knowledge. But I wanted to do more like direct work. I kept trying to like insert myself in these jobs into spaces where I could like do the work or do the trainings or things like that. And it just wasn't meant to be in those roles. And so finally one day I was like, you know what, why don't I just like try grad school for something like this and see what happens? Cause that's kind of that's my MO for most things, is let me just do this and see what happens. I do that a lot for like buying non-refundable plane tickets to go travel. And then I just go have adventures that way. So it's worked out okay so far. So then I ended up going to grad school, and the rest is history. I mean, it was just such a good fit. And now being in a private practice after doing, you know, community mental health and other nonprofit work there, it's just been really great to now have a practice where it's folks coming in who I really feel like I can help, who really want to be there, who are ready to do the work and to create the change they want to see. And it's just been really, really awesome. So yeah, that's sort of been my journey, and it's quite a windy one, but I'm happy with where I've ended up.
Do you mind if I ask how many years have you officially been in practice, or at least how many years since you were, you know, officially in your profession?
Yeah, so I've been a practicing therapist since, oh God, we're going on 5 years. So that's crazy.
5 years.
Since graduating with my master's and being qualified to practice. And then I've been in my private practice. I just hit a year this past October of owning my own practice. So that's really exciting for me. And then I've been licensed for a couple of years during that time.
Okay. And so just to explain for the listeners, because I do have quite a wide variety of audience members, and some of them are in the health and wellness field. Some of them are students. Some of them are just people who find me online. And so just to kind of compare with my profession, we have, well, now there is a required master's mandate. Before, we had to have a bachelor's degree, then an internship, and then take a national board exam. And we were pretty much on our own after that if we wanted to start a private practice. In your neck of the woods, you have a different kind of structure, don't you, as to how to go through?
Well, it's so interesting because there's multiple professions within the therapy space. So I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I have my LCSW. And then there's also in California, marriage and family therapists are a big subgroup. In other states, I know licensed professional counselors or licensed mental health counselors are a big profession. So these are different degrees and licenses that you can get to practice therapy. And then of course, there's the doctorate level psychologists and who get their PhDs or PsyDs. And so there's kind of a bunch of us who are practicing similar things, just maybe from a different lens, like the training of our particular program and profession informs the lens that we look at our work with. So that's the main difference. But once you get that degree in California, and this is the other thing, is every state's very different. Every state has their own licensing requirements. Every state has their own types of licenses. And so I can only speak to California because that's the only one I'm really familiar with. I know we're working on national, you know, it being the same nationally, which would be really great. So anyway, In California, you graduate with your master's, and master's is required, as far as I know, in all of the types of professions: social work, marriage, family therapy, counseling. You need your master's, and while you're in your master's, you do a couple of internships. And then when you graduate, you have to do 3,000 hours of supervised professional work. And so you do that as an associate, and then you can apply for your license, and there's a board exam. That is a national exam, as far as I know. And yeah, then you have to, renew it every 2 years and do a bunch of continuing education. So we're always doing more and more research and learning more knowledge within our field, which is good, but expensive. So
Yes,
yeah,
us
that's sort
too.
of the process for us. It sounds actually pretty similar, just, kind of done a little differently.
Yeah, I think the amount of hours that you have to put in behind the scenes, and if I'm not mistaken, too, before moving into private practice, there's also a little bit more oversight, if I'm not mistaken, in your profession than there is in ours. A lot of us were like hitting the ground running, completely unaware of what to expect, and
Oh
only
yeah,
kind of like reaching
same.
out to colleagues. And you and I have a bunch of things, as I always do. I'm scribbling notes down here. So we will eventually talk about healthcare and insurance and maybe some other things about how we reach our potential or important clients that are hopefully finding us. But I wanted to go back for a second because the discussion around fearlessness and finding your calling and settling into something that feels really comfortable, but knowing that if you did not take that chance, if even if you failed or didn't, you weren't successful in it, it's still something that you would have wanted to do. That's kind of not a theme that comes up a lot in these interviews, but it has come up before with not regretting anything. And again, realizing there is privilege in that of being able to just say, I'm going to follow my path. But I also try to tell people to empower them that, even a small change could be quite significant in whatever you're setting out to do. So this kind of comes up with, not necessarily boundary settings, but also how much we kind of put on ourselves and how much we expect of other people. And then tying that in also to maybe some of the conversations that you might have in sessions about feeling confined to something and knowing that there might be something else that you want to pursue, but maybe not having the ability or the power to do that. What are some things that you feel were kind of innate that allowed you to run through? And what are some suggestions that you might have for people who are a little bit more leery, weary, unsure?
I think for me personally, I've been very fortunate to kind of have this belief in myself, and it's not always there. I want to be clear, it is not always there, but I think fundamentally it is there, that I believe that whatever happens, I'm gonna get through it. Like, there's no other option, So I think I've operated for myself with this belief system of, like, whatever happens, I'm gonna find some way to work through it, because I don't feel like there's any other alternative to that. So in the case of, being afraid to book my first non-refundable solo trip out of the country, I was like, what am I doing? And then I did it, and it was great because I had to figure it out, and that comes with its bumps along the way. But I think a part of what I do a lot of my work too with clients is reminding them that as humans, we're going to have uncomfortable experiences, whether those are things that, because of choices we made, or just they're out of our control and they just happen, because that happens a lot too. And it's really not about avoiding that discomfort. It's not about not it's not about, like, expecting it to never happen to you. It's about how to cope with it when it does, because it will. That's part of the human experience. We do not have control over everything. And once you're able to sort of come from that, it's slightly like existential, but once you're able to come to that place of acceptance of just, like, things are going to happen, and yes, some of those things are not, like, by choice, but I do have some, however small, some choice in what happens next based on how I choose to respond. So for me, that has been a really great guiding tool for, like, whatever happens, it doesn't mean I'm going to like it. It doesn't mean it's going to be fun for me or not stressful, but do I believe I can get through it? Yes. So that has helped me. And I think for folks who maybe are not quite at that point with their own belief in themselves, which is totally fine and normal, and so much of what I see every day, right? People who are on that journey, that's okay. You don't need to fully be there yet. But maybe reminding yourself, like, what is this? is this in alignment towards like the life I want to be leading? Am I making choices or doing things or rather not doing things that are, you know, kind of on the way of what I want my life to look like? Am I moving towards that path or away from it? That's one great question to ask yourself. Another question to ask yourself would be, what would I tell someone that I love who's in a similar position? Would I tell them to not go for it? Would I try to encourage them? How would I support them? What kind of support do I need? So I guess what I'm really getting at is a lot of self-reflection of what's the fear here? What's the fear story that your brain is telling you? And is there another story that can come out of this experience? And all that to say that there's going to be times where it's okay to be afraid and maybe you're not ready to take some leap yet, and that's fine. But in regards to sort of this discussion we're talking about of stumbling into things, there's always the ability to backtrack. It's always okay to change course along the way. If you try something and it doesn't work out for you, you're not stuck there. You know, 99.9% of the time, whatever it is, there's a way to change course. And so that can be really comforting too.
I agree with that too. You know, I was, as you're talking, I'm also thinking of just external messaging, but also internal messaging, the things that we say to ourselves, what you mentioned, how would you speak to a loved one if you were trying to give them some feedback? And then also kind of the pros and cons of depending on who we are following, whether we are talking about in social media or just as far as influencers in our life. You know, a lot of times I hear things when I'm working with my students, we talk a lot about modifiable factors and things that could potentially put you at risk for a disease, but also things that are quote unquote within our control. And then I look at messages of some, you know, maybe commercials of like, hey, if I can do it, so can you. And I'm like, not always. Like sometimes there are definitely some things in there. And so even if it's a small change that is related to, you know, stopping smoking or reducing the amount of alcohol you take in or increasing the amount of fruits and vegetables you're doing. Again, a lot of those things aren't just as easy as from going from point A to point B. There's a lot of these like mini steps in between things. So, I mean, as a former smoker myself, this took me almost, I think, 4 years to finally quit after smoking for 23 years. And even during my smoking days, which I'm sure right now, as people who know me and are listening to this are like, what? Yeah, I was a closeted smoker. Like it was a disgusting habit I didn't want people to know about, but it was very addictive and it was really hard to come off of it. And I needed a ton of guidance and support. And also because I think I was closeted, it felt very, you know, I was flying solo in a lot of things. So I was able to overcome that. But that is technically considered a modifiable risk factor of something that could lead to, you know, heart disease, cancer, et cetera, down the line. So it's, yes, it's about prioritizing some things, but also really feeling empowered to be able to overcome some of those triggers and those cues and those kind of like knee-jerk automatic reactions. Can we talk a little bit about that too, Laura, of things that you've kind of learned and maybe implemented both in yourself and some of the things that you might see in session? How do you break through that kind of that habit, or how do you like make or break habits that just feel like they are part of your life? You know, building a routine, getting up at 5 a.m., starting to do smoothies. It's not easy sometimes to just make these small changes. So can you speak a little bit about that too?
Oh, I sure can. And you might have to pause me at some point because I could just go off. So there's two words that are coming to my head initially. One of them is mindfulness, because we can't implement anything, whether it's a change or a new habit or whatever it is, without first becoming aware of what's getting in the way of it and what the pattern already is. And so when I have, for example, a lot of clients who struggle with talking to themselves really negatively, or you know, maybe there's a lot of shame around what they feel like they're not doing or whatnot, we have to first start being mindful and becoming more aware of when those thoughts are there and what's happening around those moments. And then we can start to, again, look for, if that's the fear story, if that's the shame story, then we can start looking around for other stories. What's the story? What are the things that are saying I'm actually capable of doing this, so that I have been able to do some of these things? And so that's a big piece of it, is just start being mindful of what's happening in those moments. Because when anything's on autopilot, we lose all sense of mindfulness. It's just automatic at that point. So that would be like the very first thing to look at. And then I would say the other thing that's coming to mind too is just starting small, because so many folks are like, oh, well, I want to start this habit. I'm going to start working out, and then I'm going to change up my entire eating patterns. I'm going to do this and this and this to get more sleep. And that's just so much, you know, when there's a reason why it's not happening. There's some barrier there that we have to explore, and we got to figure out what that is and what's getting in the way so that we can problem solve that. But the, you know, the truth is, like, telling ourselves that we have to do all these things and making that expectation so high is going to set us up for failure. And then every time we have that perceived failure, then it's just another notch on that story of I can't do this, or I'm a piece of shit, or whatever it is. And so we really, really want to focus on those small steps, those small wins, because that's going to encourage us to keep going. And that's how habit change is formed. The other thing I said, two words came to my head. The other one was values. So what are your values? What are the things that are important to you in life? What are the things that, you know, you really identify with that become a source of grounding for you, things that you anchor yourselves to? Because once you know what those are, and I do this exercise with almost every client, and so many of them kind of have this idea of what their values are, or we go through this exercise and it's like, oh, that's a should value. That's something I feel like I should value, but maybe I don't actually. And then we can dig into what is truly important to them, not what they think should be important to them. From there, we can figure out, am I moving towards alignment with those things, or right away from that? And if I'm moving away from that, what's the reason? Again, what's getting in the way? What are the barriers here? Not from a shame perspective, because the story you could say to yourself is, why am I not doing this? I should be doing this. Everyone around me can do this. Why can't I? But rather curiosity, not judgment, curiosity of like, what's really happening here for me? What's really getting in the way? What is my, you know, inability to move forward trying to tell me? What's that fear trying to tell me? Then you can just, you know, figure out from there what's really happening. And that's going to be your path forward.
Oh my gosh, that is so deep, but also scary, I think, to a lot of people.
Yes, very scary.
And as you're talking too, and I think you and I spoke about this during our live, if I'm not mistaken, because a few words came up to me while you were speaking: patience, compassion, sustainability, right? So this need for immediate gratification, everything's got to be done in flipping 30 days, or like a 7-day challenge or whatever. And we can't, I don't think we are physically and mentally able or capable to make such quick changes on such a short amount of time and have that be long lasting. So yes,
right,
we can do quick things and see immediate results, but like, is that going to guide us down into a long-term ability to keep maintaining that particular thing?
Yeah, we're talking about sustainability, right? So if we do something that's just quick, but it's like really hard and it's super drastic, that's not sustainable.
No, not at all. And I think in the world that I work in, especially since we're talking about people's, you know, health conditions, and a lot of times, of course, as much as I don't love focusing on it, we also talk about weight discussions too.
Yeah.
And that we talk about things that cycle over and over again. So people tend to, you know, do something drastic to make a short change, and then they can't stick with it, and then something else happens, and you're really putting your physical body, but also your mental body as well, in jeopardy when you're constantly cycling over and over, instead of just kind of writing things out and also, you know, being happy and healthy in a way that you define it, not in the way that, quote, recommended or given in the guidelines, because those are very general approaches to take, but we are each individual humans that have different things going on underneath it all, biochemically and otherwise. And so I think, you know, what you mentioned too, of kind of sitting with something, I don't know if a lot of people even are aware of, like, taking a beat and just allowing yourself to kind of sit in something and process something and not make that knee-jerk reaction. And how do you force yourself to, like, be patient? Just, like, slow the roll, man. How does that happen?
That's the magic question. What I tell folks, and this is something I struggle with too, because I tend to be very restless and go, 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 go. So sitting in stillness for me is very tough. And what I try to do, and what I tell folks to do or advise them to do, is to just take it, again, one step at a time. So if you can only sit there for like 30 seconds before you get extremely uncomfortable, okay, we'll start there. And if you do get that extreme discomfort, be curious about it. I think that's probably going to be my theme, is to just approach these things with curiosity rather than judgment. Because again, every time you step forward into that like place of shame or judgment, you're just kicking yourself, and it's just going to be cyclical. So in those moments where you're trying to be still, notice what that feels like in your body. I know, you know, there's a joke about therapists saying that all the time, but that's because it's true. Like, we really do hold those emotions, that anxiety, that fear, those feelings in our body. And that can tell us so much about A, what we're experiencing, even if our brain doesn't want to admit that we're experiencing it, and B, also how to release it. So if I'm feeling something in my gut or I'm feeling something in my shoulders, that's going to give me information about what do I need? Maybe I need to move my body. Maybe I need to, you know, find food that feels good to me, that makes my body feel good. Maybe I need to, you know, get some rest if I'm feeling a lot of heaviness, a lot of like weight on myself. So thinking about what that feels like for you. And that comes back to the mindfulness piece. And then from there, you can sit in those moments of stillness or sit in that mindfulness and just take a beat. Because I've heard that from almost every single person I've worked with of like, I don't know how to just sit still. Like, what do you mean sit with the feeling? And I mean just that, sit with it and notice how it's uncomfortable and where that's showing up for you.
I 100% agree, because we also talk about, well, I mean, you and I have discussed the thing, and you just mentioned the word gut, right? So the gut and brain axis and how those things work together, but also how stress and inability to process certain things can really manifest in actual disease. I mean, yes, high blood pressure, right, is part of whatever, high salt intake and different kinds of disease states can also lead to cardiovascular disease, but you could also have a heart attack because you're stressing out over so much stuff.
Yes.
And I actually just posted something on this the other day where even in a bustling, disgusting, dirty underground subway, I was so in my brain and I felt like I hadn't taken a single moment to myself in about 10 hours for that whole day, that I just sat myself on the bench, on the platform, in the subway station, and just literally just sat there. Just sat there and kind of gave myself a body scan and noticed a lot of tension, because if I just ran up those stairs, I felt like I could see myself tripping or hurting my back or doing something that was going, like I wasn't being mindful in that moment.
Yeah.
And it was so eye-opening to me that I was like, this is gross. I'm in this disgusting underground subway station, but it really served a purpose right there, Laura, for me just to be in my moment and just be able just to calm down for a second, just sit and be with it.
I love that story so much, because it shows that like you needed it so much that it was made to happen. Like
had it to happen.
It had to happen. Exactly. Whatever else was going on in that moment was secondary to that, you needing that. And I think that that's exactly what we're talking about, because when our body feels dysregulated, which like you said, is a lot of times related to our mental state and the thoughts we're having and the feelings we're having, that shows up in our body. And then when it does, that's when our nervous system kicks in. I'm sure we're going to get into a whole discussion about this. That's when our nervous system kicks in. And then, as I like to call it, your brain goes out to lunch. And so you're less likely to respond to things or make choices that, once again, are in alignment with your values, because you're not thinking about your values. You're thinking about just getting through, right? And so if we're able to calm down our bodies or get them back to that equilibrium or give them what they need and nourish them in such a way that then, you know, they feel more stabilized, then our brain can come back from its lunch break, and then we can sort of make those responses and choices that are intentional and mindful, rather than just reacting to whatever's happening. You know, that natural reaction is a nervous system response, whereas we want to be making true intentional responses in alignment with ourselves, our values, our goals, etc.
This is where choices are made, whether we say yes or no to things, whether those yes or no's are impulse reactions to something, whether it's yes or no to food, whether it's yes or no to job offers. I mean, there are a lot of times, and you know what you just said before about you can kind of come back to things. I've accepted things that I've turned around and said, you know what, on second thought, I really like, I kind of process this and visualize what that would mean for me, and I just don't think I'm the right person, or it's not the right time, I'm so sorry. And nobody's ever been like, well, that's it, you know, we're going to like set fire to your house because you've disappointed.
Yeah, how dare you?
Yeah, it's like they've gone on their way. And I've often told myself too, if this were the other way around, where they had to pull the plug or a contract had, you know, fallen through, there would be no hard feelings. It would be a little bit, you know, upsetting at some point, but I'm not going to personally like hate anybody for having to rescind an offer for me. So let's talk a little bit about that with, you know, the discussion around anxiety or thoughts or whatever stress factors might happen there, of how we might end up not making the decisions that are best for us, whether we're talking about health or other, you know, relationships or anything that you might be able to fit in about, I don't know, 6 minutes or so.
Okay, no pressure. Well, the first thing that's coming to my mind is like, what is a moment of anxiety, right? So anxiety is a truly basic human emotion that that comes from our primal sort of survival instinct, right? That fight or flight response, which we now know with research is a fight, flight, freeze, perhaps even fawn response. And so when that happens, when we perceive a threat, our brain's not like, oh, this is this threat. This is not life threatening. Our body kicks in instead. And it's like, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm in a forest and there's a bear and I have to make a snap judgment and survive. That's what's happening. Even if at any time that we're triggered by maybe something from a past trauma, maybe something that's like a deep rooted fear that we have, anytime we get that trigger, it activates that nervous system response. And some folks are able to sort of counter that more in the moment than others. And that's where a lot of the work that I do comes in. But it's that idea that, yeah, so I'm now anxious. I'm now that anxiety tells me some story either about myself or about the world around me or something along those lines. And then that nervous system response is so, you know, instinctual that I just react. And so what that might look like in a moment of anxiety is a fight response could look like, you know, getting really defensive and arguing if this is a situation with another person, or a flee response might look like, you know, just shutting down and not, or I guess it's more of a freeze response, but either way, we're responding in such a way that's really not something that we're thinking about. And so we have to figure out a way to soothe ourselves, because otherwise those stories that we're telling in our heads, whether that's anxious thoughts, anxious beliefs, I'm a bad person, I'm not good enough, I'm going to fail, whatever that is, that's now developing a story. And then your lens is only going to look for things that confirm that story. We develop a confirmation bias when this happens. So not only are we responding in a way that's usually out of alignment with what we actually want to be doing, but we're also now perpetuating and feeding into this storyline that's maybe not the most true or accurate, and certainly not the most helpful. Ooh, so what we have, yeah, right?
Deep.
Yeah, and this is all automatic. This is all in the span of a couple seconds. And so we're not thinking about this process happening. That's why I come back to mindfulness a lot with my clients and just building that awareness of, oh, I notice I'm catastrophizing. Because even then, if you still do it, you're sort of able to separate yourself enough to be like, that's what I'm doing. And it doesn't feel as like core, I am this, or this is objectively happening. You're sort of able to see it even if you can't fully pull yourself out of it. And then from there, we build to get to that place where you're able to notice that that's what you're doing, push it aside, and act accordingly. But sometimes that can be a cognitive process, and other times that's a primal bodily process that we have to actually soothe our body first because our nervous system is out of whack. So I hope that that made sense to folks. I know that we got like really nitty gritty in there, but yeah, so there's both a cognitive and a physiological process that happens basically anytime we're triggered with anxiety. For that,
I feel like that actually relieves me a little bit to know, you know, like I'm in control, but also there are things that are without in my control. These are actual automatic responses that my body is just going to be taking place. And it's almost like I have to slow it down, be aware, hit the brakes. And that then could take a little while for me to recognize when that happens.
And for folks who are wondering, you know, why does this happen more to me when people around me seem like they can handle it just fine? I want to just address that too, because that's something I hear a lot is the otherness and feeling like you're the only one who experiences this. You're not. A lot of people experience this. And part of the reason is because our responses to things are based on our past experiences. They're based on maybe what was modeled for us as children. They're based on experiences we've had with other people who maybe showed us that it was safe to express ourselves in a certain way, or that it was incredibly unsafe to express ourselves. And so we learned how to not do that. That's a big reason why a freeze or a fawn response can become your normal reaction. You know, we learn these from our cultural values, from our family values, from all these different things that make up our worldview. And I just wanted to speak to that because everyone is going to have a different response. And so even if it looks like someone else, this isn't a big problem for them, we don't actually know that that's true. They could be having their own internal thing, but it's not because there's something wrong with you. It's because we all just do the best we can with the knowledge we have, and the coping skills that we develop in our lives are adaptive until they're not. And so a lot of times people get to this adult age and they're like, hey, so I used to do this a lot to you know, survive. And now it's getting in the way. It's no longer adaptive, but we don't know how to change it because it's the norm.
Yes. And I think that's something that I know on my end, my clients and patients get a little bit frustrated with, where the answers are sometimes, well, it depends. It depends on the situation, the person, again, like you mentioned too, the past behaviors, the past experiences, you cannot, realizing that we have some sort of overarching guidelines, dietary guidelines, recommendations to follow and to apply for certain conditions or whatever we're doing as far as, you know, the eating groups and things like that, that we're encouraging people, but we still have to individualize and customize all of that stuff. So it's not going to just be this plug and play automatically to every single person. You still have to take that into consideration. And that's something that, again, I really do hope people allow themselves the patience and compassion to sit with that too, and recognize, even though it seems that other people might have it better and faster and differently than you do, just like you said, Laura, it's possible that's the case, or it's possible that's just the ideal front facing that they're showing you, and to just be careful and, you know, conscientious that behind the scenes, we don't know everything.
Yes, 100%. I would argue that most of the time, that's really what's happening.
Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah. So
I want to talk a little bit, as much as you want to disclose, what is kind of like a current or maybe typical week in the life of you, in addition to just your work? I know you also do some professional development things on your own. You also have your own passions of different things that you enjoy on how to satisfy your own mental and physical needs. Can you share a little bit about, you know, kind of like your routine or what your schedule might be like?
Yeah. And full disclosure, I haven't perfected my routine yet. I am definitely still a work in progress with that. So I hope that that normalizes things for a lot of folks who might also be struggling there, because I believe in the importance of routines, but I'm just not always perfect with them. So I would say that I typically get up around between 7 and 7:30 in the morning on a good day, make my coffee, usually do some admin work before starting a day full of sessions with clients. I see folks from Mondays through Thursdays, and then say Fridays for just sort of my whatever admin days, social media days, things like that. In that time, I try to really hold space for myself to eat. That's sometimes really hard when you're just kind of on autopilot or you get into like a hyper focus. So I try to eat something in the morning with my coffee, and then I try to eat something between 12 and 2 in the afternoon so that I'm not a raging, you know, wild monster by dinner time, because that can happen if I'm not careful. I try to schedule 1 to 2 social things per week. Sometimes it's a lot more than that, and then I need time to recharge. Other times I don't even hit that quota, and then I feel like something's missing. So I really try to prioritize my social interaction without overcommitting, which is definitely, like I said, still a work in progress for me. And what's cool about working from home, I would say, is that I get to be around my partner and my cat. So that's been really good for my mental health while I'm going through, you know, in between sessions or during breaks. And that's been really nice. But I would say, like, for me, I really try to have things that I enjoy. That looks like reading. I take dance classes. I sing with an a cappella group sometimes. And so really just trying to keep yourself focused on things in balance, I would say, with things that are, yes, the important sort of obligation things like work or family or whatever else, but also the more just enjoyable things that are true to who you are, the things that you know, are your unique interests and hobbies and your relationships too, because that's how we become a well-rounded person. And it's not always going to be perfectly in balance. You know, there's going to be some times where you have to focus more on certain things and other things might fall by the wayside, but it's really important to check in with yourself periodically and ask, is this how I want to be delegating my time? Because that's the resource we don't get back.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. Absolutely. I know with being an adjunct lecturer and having a lot of discussions with my students, that I understand the importance and the prioritization of things that are time sensitive, especially when there are large projects, exams coming up, you know, kind of cramming things in or having to study and not necessarily getting the subject matter and having it add in a little bit more time to your day or your week. But I also really keep encouraging everybody. And I try to, like you said too, Laura, I'm a human person trying to take some of my own advice, but I think it's important to make sure that you establish some non-negotiables. So even if it's like, you know, at the end of the day or during the day, if all things considered, I want to make sure I'm at least eating, you know, one nourishing meal or having at least 30 minutes just to myself where I can have an empty brain and just empty things out and de-stress a little bit, or you know, meditate, journal, whatever it is that you want to do. Sleep is a huge thing that I keep saying, please do not sacrifice your sleep, because that will in time, if it's a pattern, do much more harm than good, unfortunately. So, you know, finding those things that are really I mean, we can all say we're too busy. We're all too busy for things. But I think, you know, kind of getting in that zone of the non-negotiables, blocking time out for ourselves and really sticking to that. I love that you schedule social time. I do the same thing too. I come across as an extrovert, but I'm actually not. But I do enjoy quality time and relationship building. So I really love being able to see my friends and hang out and go to dinners or
It's chats. So nice.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And especially since you and I both enjoy food, I like revolving around meals as well.
That's right.
And then one of the last things I wanted to ask you too, before we start wrapping up our discussion, because I cannot believe almost an entire hour has passed here, was just in general, you know, when we talk about being out there and getting our message, and you and I have had these conversations too with, you know, social media and the roles that it plays in not just building up our business, but also allowing ourselves to have a face, to have somebody who recognizes us and to grow that trust factor with our potential audience or potential clients. I've often said to you, I love the aesthetic of your Instagram page. It's so soothing. It's so soothing. And you also, you know, even though you focus on some, like the language that you use, you know, sometimes obviously when we see things that are worded like negative or red or whatever, like these can kind of instill certain reactions from us, but you actually turn it around. Like I look at some of the things that you're using in your social media and I can pick up on words that say compliments and green flags. And it makes me feel happy to be there, that it's not just about focusing on the quote unquote like negative thoughts or things that I might be afraid to think about, but also embracing the things that are pleasant. So can you share with us a little bit about the structure that, or whatever, if you even have a plan about putting together your social media, but tell us a little bit about kind of like what goes into you wanting to share certain topics.
Well, I started by just thinking about what are the things that I love to talk about? And as much as I love to talk about anxiety and trauma, and I'd love to increase awareness about that and help folks navigate those things and really give them practical tools to take away from, I think that's really important and what people are often looking for. I think it's just as important to notice that I love talking about the good stuff. I love showing people how to set boundaries. I love showing people what their inherent worth is and helping them to see that and giving them tools in the same way to learn how to notice those things. Because for so many people, again, it's that ingrained sense of this is not how I'm used to talking to myself. So I don't even know where to start. So I think it's important to always balance out, you know, in the work that I do, so many folks are coming because something's not working, right? You see this sometimes, I suppose, but with insurance and the way that it all works, you don't always get folks who are coming just, you know, to be preventative. You get people who are coming because, you know, they're stuck and they don't know what to do next, or they just really have reached a point where they feel like they need help. And my favorite question to ask during my intakes with folks is, you know, after we've gone over their symptoms and what's happening in their history and all that stuff, I'll ask them, what are your strengths? And I would say like 8 out of 10 times people are just like, you know, and then by the end, by the time I graduate somebody from therapy, I ask them again, what are your strengths? And they have a whole list. And it's just like the most beautiful thing to see when folks are learning how to recognize those things about themselves. So I really do feel like, especially in a context where people are coming to me with quote unquote problems, I really want to hone in on like, yes, those are there. And also, so are your strengths. Also, that's not the only thing that defines you. Also, there's so much more to you than just these problems you're telling me about. And so I try to like incorporate that idea on my Instagram too, for all the posts about things that aren't working and how to deal with that. I also want to remind people that there is good in the world and there is good in themselves.
Oh my gosh, you just made my heart flutter. You really did, because you reminded me too, well, I do this, I think, sometimes myself. If I have to start with something positive, I'll end up veering off in a direction and I'm like, oh, that's not positive anymore. And same thing with my client sessions, where I've said, you know, okay, share with me some successes. And it goes off into the challenges discussion. And I'm like, wait, so hold on, were there no successes there? Did you not?
Yeah.
And they just, oh, I forgot, or I didn't realize, or, you know, I kind of, the not great things tend to stand out more, but as the saying goes, right, it takes more muscles to frown than it does to smile.
And right. So, or like you'll write a bad Yelp review before you write a good one.
100%. I'm guilty of that. I always say that too. People are more likely to condone than commend. And so it's really part, I just, whatever happens is part of human nature, just to focus on the negative stuff for some reason. So it feels like we're swimming upstream sometimes, but I do believe that doing that work and putting that work in to shift the focus, not that everything has to be friggin' rainbows and puppies all the time, I get it, but to really shift that focus and start off with some sort of mantra of I am good enough and I can conquer this and I have control, and just see how that feels, how that makes you feel with the things that you are doing, what, you know, the reactions that you have, the relationships that you're building.
I hope folks are walking away from this with some practical tools, some ideas on how to start being more mindful, and some of the things to start noticing in order to increase your own, you know, wellness, both physically and mentally, because they're so related.
Laura, what does the future you look like? What are you doing to establish your development professionally, personally, growing your business? Tell us a little bit about some of the ideas and the things that you see for yourself in the future.
Ooh, I love that. I'm full of ideas always. I have 10 million tabs open in my brain at all times. So I've started to sort of branch out. So I do clinical work, obviously my private practice, but I also have been contracting with some organizations to create content like for their apps or for their websites. And that's been a really fun sort of side project. In the new year, I'm going to be looking into offering clinical supervision for some folks who are starting their hours post-graduation. That's going to be an exciting adventure. I've just joined the board for the Los Angeles chapter of the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists. So we'll be making some local level change and hopefully bringing forward the therapist community in my area to get together and network and have a lot of cool opportunities together. So I'm trying to just dip my toes in a million different things. Might do some workshops next year, always looking for new places to do that. And just, it keeps it interesting. You know, it keeps it, it helps me just continue to learn, which I think is such a important aspect of both our professions, I think, of just staying up to date with knowledge and research and learning as much as we can to help the people we work with. So it helps to, you know, stay involved in that process, keep taking those continuing education courses, but also to just do a variety of things that keep me interested. And of course, on a personal level for me, that also looks like a lot of traveling. I love to travel and expose myself to other cultures and learn, you know, different cultures, and of course, enjoy different cuisines. So
yes,
that is definitely on my list for this upcoming year, is to get back into that now that, you know, the situation with the world is calming. We're not out of the woods, but it's calming.
Right. I love that. I was going to say, as far as the professional growth and networking, that's something very important, especially for anybody who's listening to this, who is planning on going into either business for themselves or establish yourself as kind of like an expert in your field, is to really branch out and network with people. And you never know, just like Laura and I, where collaborations can happen, where you can pick up different things and learn different things, and also maybe even refer or partner up with different clients, sharing and making sure that you're all kind of like supporting each other. But also, I think, Laura, this also provides access in a variety of different ways for our potential audience and patient population, that we have different places that they can find us, whether it's fee-based or free, like we're doing right now. This is a discussion that they can listen to and learn a little bit more about what you and I do. And so, you know, again, allowing yourself to establish things outside of what may be confining you within your profession. Mm-hmm. And like you said, dipping that toe into all these different waters. Where would you plan on, where are you traveling? Are you giving away next country?
Well, I've got some plans. Let's see. I might visit my friend who lives in the United Kingdom. She just moved there. And so it's a great excuse to go there again. I love, you know, England, and we might hit up Wales. And then I like to do, this is just a fun thing for me, I love Christmas time. I love winter, because, you know, I live in LA, so like winter doesn't exist here. And so I think I might try to do like a Christmas market trip somewhere in Europe, maybe France, Switzerland. I like to go to Christmas markets. It's something that I've been doing the last few years. This year, we're not going out of town at all, but next year, I think next year is going to be the big Switzerland year. So we'll see if that plays out.
Oh, that's so fun. That's so fun. Good. Well,
Christmas markets are the best.
They're so fun, so colorful and engaging. And I was going to say, wherever you do end up going, obviously safe and happy travels to you.
Oh, thank you. And likewise, if you go on any adventures.
Venture out. So my last final questions, my two questions are somewhat related. both literally and figuratively, what is on your plate today? So after we are done discussing our conversation and we disconnect here, what is the next thing you might be working on? And then what is your next meal?
Oh, good questions. Well, I'm about to out myself on how big of a nerd I am because a bunch of friends and I and my partner's coming with us. We are all doing like a board game night tonight. Happy Saturday, party hard.
Love
we're
it.
gonna be we're gonna be doing board games, but I think before that I might head out to my local cafe and just get some work done. I got commissioned to do some articles that are due next week, so it might be smart to work on those. So that's sort of my agenda for today. My next meal, what is my next meal going to be? It's probably going to be whatever they serve at the game night. I know there's going to be some charcuterie. So that is not a meal, but it is delicious.
Food is food, as I say.
That's
food
right.
Food.
That's right. I think we're gonna have a variety of different appetizers and such. And so that can be really fun on a, you know, in a little party situation like that. But
that is absolutely fun.
I think tomorrow my plan is to have waffles for breakfast because I've been craving some waffles and I think it's time to just make it happen.
We just came full circle with the breakfast conversation.
Yeah.
Laura, it has been such a pleasure getting to learn a little bit more about you, having you on here and sharing your insight. I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you so much for
everything. Oh, thank you so much, Dina, for having me. It's always a joy to talk with you.
Likewise, my friend.
Thank you so much for joining me this week on the Dish with Dina podcast. I am Dina D'Alessandro, registered dietitian, nutritionist, founder, and chief executive life changer at Dish with Dina, and I'm also your host. If you like what you heard, I would be so grateful if you could subscribe to this podcast, leave a review, and share this with others who you think might benefit from what we have to offer on these episodes. You can also join my mailing list at dishwithdina.com or email me at info@dishwithdina.com with questions, comments, feedback, and if you'd like to be a guest on a future episode, because everybody eats and we all have a story to share. I hope you tune back in next week when we dish again.